everyone, and welcome back to the New Plaza Cinema Podcast, the podcast made by cinephiles for cinephiles. This time around, the New Plaza Cinema crew delves into the making of Alfred Hitchcock's 1958 classic Vertigo, through sharing the lore behind all the creative decisions that shaped this alluring film into what it is today. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the podcast as we decode the symbolism and psychological depth of this film's narrative alongside Emmy-nominated documentarian and author Stephen C. Smith.
Well, it's an honor to be here with this cadre of Hitchcock and Vertigo experts this afternoon, although I'll be playing mostly a supporting role, as is often the case, running back and forth between screenings and other operations here at New Plaza Cinema. But Vertigo played a central role in my first decade of Hitchcock education, which started in the early 70s, mainly because it was one of his key films, his artistic testament, but was mostly at that time impossible to see, as he had decided to take it and several other of his films off the market to allegedly increase their eventual resale value. After a final airing on CBS TV in early 1973, it was not available until a theatrical re-release a decade later. A very frustrating decade for a generation of budding Hitchcockologists like myself. After hearing too late about occasional special screenings like Jimmy Stewart tributes at the AFI in 1976, the George Eastman House in 78, I finally saw it via a hot tip from a friend one November night in 1980 at SUNY Purchase in a film class taught by revered Professor Tom Gunning. That was the same week that Raging Bull and Heaven's Gate premiered in New York City, a week of movie going that I'll never forget. Now, our team will be covering a lot of ground today, but I guess one thing that always springs to mind for me is Jimmy Stewart in this film, as I believe Truffaut and others have noted, is like a great silent movie star in much of Vertigo. There are dozens and dozens of shots of him just looking, reacting, yearning, agonizing, behind the wheel of a car, on a stepladder, in Judy Barton's room, waiting for her to come out of the ladies, on the roof of Mission San Juan Batista, which I visited. Max, does the trailer you've chosen speak to this?
So the trailer I'm going to share with you is the original 1958 trailer that a rather panicked Paramount Pictures released because they weren't sure if the title Vertigo would be marketable or understandable at all to the general public. So it's one of my favorite trailers of the period because they're really trying to educate the public about what this unusual word that wasn't widely heard or mentioned in a film title is all about. Here's the original trailer.
Vertigo. A feeling of dizziness, a swimming in the head. Figuratively, a state in which all things seem to be engulfed in a whirlpool of terror, as created by Alfred Hitchcock in the story that gives new meaning to the word suspense.
So there are some funny examples we can share later, thanks to the excellent Dan Euler book about Vertigo, The Making of Vertigo, which came out in the 90s, this book, about some of the other titles that Paramount recommended Hitchcock use. He was at the height of his powers when he made this film, and our guest who's going to join us shortly, Stephen Smith, can tell us more about that. But at Paramount, he was given unprecedented control over his work, thanks to his agent Lou Wasserman pushing the deal through, in which he could control everything right down to the final cut, although there were issues with that. What was your reflection of upon seeing Vertigo again, Gary?
Well, I'm not the first person to have said this, but I think I was kind of tuning out the plot in some ways. We've kind of stopped having any question about the plot being believable over, you know, dozens of screenings over the times, but I think there's many other things to look at. The feelings, the moods, the visual design, and all of that is so rich. Perhaps it's not as perfect a piece of emotional or cinematographic construction as some of his other films. I think my all-time favorite is still Notorious because it's about the feelings and the emotions. And
well, it has been the subject of debate since its original release about several aspects of the narrative. Well, first of all, the fact in the very beginning, we have to suspend disbelief when we see James Stewart's Scotty Ferguson hanging from the gutter. And then we fade out and we fade into Barbara Bel Geddes' apartment and he's recuperating. How did he get down from there? So already you have to suspend belief at the very beginning. And then there was the matter of tremendous controversy, which Stephen Smith is going to talk more about, is the reveal in which we find out quite a ways into the movie what actually is going on here involving the Judy character versus the Madeline character. And was that a mistake? Was that a good thing to reveal that information? And then which part works better? Some of us like the first poetic section with Madeline and Scotty more than that last 35 minutes. But it's one of those elements. These are several elements that I think make the film continue to be talked about and debated. I think it'd be a good time to bring Stephen Smith in. You're our special guest today. Before we hear from Dan Cale, who's going to talk about the cinematographic look of Vertigo. Stephen C. Smith, I have to keep this short because the last time I tried to do justice, he said, please stop. So he's so modest. He's an Emmy-nominated documentary producer. He's written two acclaimed biographies, music by Max Steiner, and a book, A Heart at Fire Center, The Life and Music of Bernard Herrmann, very relevant to Vertigo. Needless to say, Stephen Smith, welcome back to New Plaza Cinema.
Well, thank you so much, Max and Gary. It's terrific to be with you. And yes, I'm undertaking another Hitchcock book project at the moment. More about that in a year or so, maybe. But it's a pleasure to speak about Vertigo since I had the opportunity to interview people who worked on the film, who were around the film, who knew Hitchcock, and certainly a lot about the music. But I just wanted to mention that Vertigo was one of the most difficult scripts to realize. It took many, many months and many, many drafts to have this come together. And your discussion of the implausibility of some of it reminded me of how Hitchcock struggled to find the right balance between the dreamlike quality that he wanted and really, I think, the emotions that he wanted and the rather personal themes of control and loss of control, which was one of Hitchcock's greatest fears that he brilliantly suppressed through that persona of his. And it wasn't until they brought on a writer named Samuel Taylor, it's sort of the, if not 11th hour, the 10th hour, and he's the one who created the character of Midge, played by Barbara Bel Geddes. He's the one who created a script that Jimmy Stewart signed off on because Stewart just kept saying, you know, it isn't plausible, this doesn't make sense, I don't know how to play this person. And Midge, I think, was such a key to that. And Taylor was also a San Franciscan who could bring a lot of that specificity that Hitchcock wanted. And that's something that I don't think people realize how hard Hitchcock worked to get the sounds right of ringing telephones in a certain city or the sounds of a city and then make tremendous, wild, you know, irrational story leaps. But he wanted something that was both dreamlike and rooted in reality, because as he liked to say, dreams and nightmares always feel real to us. And Vertigo is an example of that. And something else worth mentioning is it's the first and maybe the only time that Hitchcock really set out to make a commercial art film. There really wasn't such a thing as an American art film in the 50s, but at this time, French critics were starting to give him the respect that he privately felt he had been denied by American critics who wrote him off as a showman. He was very happy to have the great success and great financial rewards of his television series that began 2 years before he shot Vertigo. But again, I think that also made him feel inside, I'm not being appreciated as a filmmaker. And we'll often see posters for Vertigo that say Alfred Hitchcock's masterpiece. And I thought that was a poster from re-releases. That was the original poster. So he really set out to try to convey to people that this was a film that had aspirations beyond merely being entertaining. And I think he believed that the casting of James Stewart and Kim Novak would give him the ability to get the audience in. And it didn't lose money, but it was not the great success. It was a break-even movie, and it found its audience later. And I think Hitchcock was very, very disappointed people didn't appreciate it more at the time, and he would be gratified by the reaction to it that most people feel today, although it is still a controversial title, and some that a number of people don't like, and that's okay.
Question for you, Stephen, since you've interviewed so many people that had been associated with the film, did you get a sense from them whether at the time they were making it, they knew they were making something really extraordinarily different from anything they'd done before? Or was it just a job and they were taken aback by this unbelievable recognition it has as a major contribution to world cinema?
That's a great question. They certainly didn't feel the latter, that they were making, you know, a great film for all time. What they were really trying to do for about a year was make a film that could be produced and shot. They really forgive me for repeating myself, but they really struggle to have it make enough sense to have it have the kind of great narrative leaps that it does. I'm happy to go along with it, but I have often thought to myself, surely an ex-cop and a private detective like Scotty Ferguson would look up a picture of Madeline and realize that he's following the wrong woman. But Samuel Taylor, that screenwriter I mentioned, said years later, when the film was a great success, and happily he lived to see it, have that success, said something to the effect, and this is a paraphrase, that they took a story that was illogical to convey a story that had truths, that had emotional truths about the manipulation of women by men. Not that he articulated all these, but you know, so many of the themes that people find in Vertigo, the irrationality of passion and all the other things that Vertigo can be said to be about. So, but they knew it was special to Hitchcock. And Hitchcock spent a lot of time with his brilliant and still underrated cinematographer, Robert Burks, going over paintings by Vermeer and really talking about shot for shot what he wanted to see in the movie visually. And it's also the first film, I think, where Hitchcock and his, again, brilliant and underrated editor, George Tomasini, where they were editing the film knowing that Bernard Herrmann was going to not just write theoretically a terrific score, but write a very Hitchcockian score. And I think that Hitchcock would have cut the scenes of Stewart driving to be much shorter had he not known that Bernard Herrmann was on the film, because he and Herrmann, before a writer was assigned to the movie, he and Herrmann were talking about what the movie was about. That's how close those two men were, that Benny, as he was called, was on this movie for about 2 years. You know, he spent 2 months perhaps writing the score, but he spent 2 years talking about it with Hitchcock. And I find that remarkable. And there's a great story that I believe is true. Herrmann loved to tell it, which is that when it came to the scene where Judy becomes Madeline, you know, where she reveals herself in that wonderful ghostly light in the apartment to Scotty, that Benny, who was visiting the set, as he often did, Herrmann said, "We will just have the camera and you." And he liked to flatter his collaborators, but that's pretty much what he did. You know, there's no dialogue from the time that she appears as Madeline again. And again, he was so confident, rightly, that Herrmann was going to deliver the goods and create something spectacular that he allowed the film to be long. And it's one of Hitchcock's longest films to that time. And the rhythms of it are strange. You can't break it down into a three-act structure the way movies are now.
Very true, because you open with that tremendously dramatic scene on the rooftop with Ferguson and the policeman pursuing that felon across the roof and the tragedy that takes place, all visual. Then right. You have two very dialogue-intensive scenes that follow, the scene in Midge's apartment.
He said that only another emotional shock could do it, and probably wouldn't. You're not going to go diving off another rooftop to find out.
I think I can lick it.
Where there's a lot of backstory and a lot of explanation, a lot of talking. Then we go to Galvin Elster's office, where once again, there's a lot of talking going on. Compelling talking, but a lot of talking. And then we go into that extraordinary dialogue-less montage that starts at Ernie's, the restaurant, and we follow Scotty following Madeline. And there was a copy of one of the final draft of Vertigo, and it was called From Among the Dead, that was circulating around. And I noticed in the shooting script, the scene in Galvin Elster's office originally was to have continued with Elster in voiceover talking about his wife and how she was seduced by San Francisco. And it's a long passage of dialogue that was supposed to have taken place over the Ernie sequences.
Right.
And I'm so grateful that Hitchcock and said, okay, we've had enough talk now. We need, because imagine how the impact would have been lost, that magnificent scene where Kim Novak makes her appearance. You don't need that narration.
You're exactly right, Max. They decided, Herrmann and Hitchcock, and really everyone decided that there was a world of reality and a world of dreams for a lot of this film. And I love the way that they compress the exposition into those scenes. Psycho is the same way. And you really notice it if you go to see the film shown with the score played live by an orchestra. And I don't generally think those work very well because concert halls are built acoustically different from movie theaters. So they usually turn the subtitles on the Blu-ray they're showing or the DCP of the film that they're showing just so people can hear the dialogue. But because both Vertigo and Psycho concentrate so much of the exposition into scenes that aren't scored and then have these lengthy, reels almost, there's an entire reel practically without dialogue, Hitchcock absolutely wanted the music and the rhythms and the editing to have a sort of hypnotic trance-like effect on people. It certainly does, I would say, for many people.
Absolutely. And Stephen, perhaps you can correct a myth here, because in the very famous interview that Truffaut did with Hitchcock, he indicated, well, there were two French novelists who wanted you to make one of their books into a film. And so they wrote Vertigo with the hope that you would buy it. And Hitchcock didn't know that. And Dan Euler, in his book, shoots that theory down. Anything to add? I have not read the novel. I believe Dan, who's coming up shortly, has. Yes. But anything to add to that?
No, I'll just say that I think Dan Euler's book is superbly researched. Oh, it's a tremendous tool. I think anyone who loves Vertigo should own this book. It really takes you on the set each day and takes you through post-production in a wonderful way. So I have full faith in Dan's research on that point. I will say that a film that I'm sure you have shown, Diabolique by Clouzot, who was being called the Gallic Hitchcock or the French Hitchcock, certainly both Psycho and Vertigo, I think, owe a nod to the fact that Clouzot was getting attention. And Hitchcock, one thing that's interesting about Hitchcock that most people don't know is he rarely cited other films or filmmakers, and sometimes very disingenuously acted as if he didn't even know what was coming out. Well, you can go to the Margaret Herrick Library in Los Angeles, where his family, and I'm so grateful they did, have donated his papers and the production files. And it is astonishing how many contemporary films, from musicals to comedies to thrillers, that were coming out, and European cinema, that Hitchcock was privately having screened, either at his very nice offices at Paramount or his palatial offices later at Universal with his private screening room and dining room. But he was looking at everything that came out, but then kind of, like to project the notion that he was sui generis, that everything just came out of his own, idea. And that's fine. That was part of his approach. But I think he was very keen to what other people were making, to answer your question, but only made things that he really believed in. And it's astonishing to me that for that great period of the 50s, that, every year there's a Hitchcock movie coming out. And so many of them are great. They range from good to great, I think.
And it's amazing that a movie was coming out every year, because this film was made under a lot of problems. There were health crises in the Hitchcock household. Hitchcock had two situations going on. His wife became ill for a while. And he was inactive for a while, but yet he was still making this one picture a year.
Exactly. Yeah, nothing could stop him. I mean, even though Hitchcock once said, when asked to describe his idea of bliss, I think he said a perfect horizon, I'm paraphrasing, he was a workaholic, and he always made sure that one film was well into development while he was shooting another. So while he was filming Vertigo, Ernest Lehman was busy putting the finishing touches on North by Northwest. And incredibly, at the same time, then Norman Lloyd and Joan Harrison would come over from Universal and run all the scripts of the TV show past him, or at least the premises. They would boil down the episodes usually to a page, or they'd say, here are the ones we think you'd like to direct this season. So he thrived on that kind of work. And I think it was only possible because, as anyone in any field knows, you need a great team. And he had a team of absolute all-stars, and, arguably they're at their peak here and on North by Northwest. And, he varied a little for Psycho by using mostly his television crew that did a superb job. But even then, he kept two people from his movie team, the editor George Tomasini and Bernard Herrmann, because he wanted to make sure that he had them for the post. But yeah, you're seeing Hitchcock at the height of his powers. And certainly with Vertigo, I think using all of the collateral that you build up as a successful commercial filmmaker to do something that might be non-commercial, and certainly proved to be to a certain extent in its day.
I just can't imagine working on a film like Vertigo as a director and multitasking with other projects. How could you even distract yourself? I mean, there's so much in Vertigo that demands 100% of our attention. You said that he screened a lot of films. One of them, I would imagine, would have had to have been Pushover with Kim Novak and Fred McMurray that Richard Quine directed. Because it's an excellent suspense noirish picture that's a good vehicle for her. And
There were so many movies. I wish I could remember them all off the top of my head. I don't remember that was officially listed, but certainly he would have looked at Kim Novak films because he was reluctant. Well, he was disappointed, let's say, in her hiring. And he seems to be one of the very few, if not only ones, who was. Everybody was thrilled. Paramount was thrilled. He so strongly envisioned Vera Miles, who was his protege at the time, in that role, that when she had to leave the production, and then a far more bankable star like Kim Novak came in, he just never could quite accept her in the role. And I have to say that when Vertigo didn't make money, he kind of privately threw Jimmy Stewart under the bus a little bit, saying that Stewart was too old. At the same time, he maintained a good relationship with Stewart, who had a piece of this movie, incidentally, just like he did on Rear Window. And they were friends, they were good colleagues. But both Bernard Herrmann and then after the film's release, Hitchcock felt that James Stewart was too old or it wasn't right to cast him in this role. I completely disagree. But again, part of the fun of Vertigo is that it elicits very strong feelings. I remember taking friends to when it was re-released finally in 1983. To see it. We were college students, and I was already in love with it and had seen it several times and was getting ready to write my book on Herman. They hated it because to them it was just illogical, it was bizarre, and it made me aware for the first time that this was not a film for everyone.
Everybody's reaction is different. And also, as I maybe indicated earlier, it's different at different times of your life when you see
Very much
it. I've noticed
so.
that. It's like
Very much so.
it's
And
strange,
I,
it's harrowing,
yeah.
it's touching, it's what the heck?
Yeah. Hitchcock would jokingly say that he followed the saying of, I forget which French playwright, torture the women. And certainly Judy Barton is tortured to the extreme in this and is the real tragic character as well, I think. But at the same time, you look at Hitchcock's films and he created arguably more sympathetic women who are victorious than any filmmaker of his time from the 1920s through the 1970s. So his depiction of women is extremely complex, and it's never more complex than in this film.
And also, I mean, Jimmy Stewart's character is pretty tortured too. I mean, in his own, he's carrying his own demons. Wonderfully stated, though. Let us now invite our cinematography expert and filmmaker, Daniel Cahill, to discuss the visual look of Vertigo, which was a Paramount picture in VistaVision.
And I remember with the first time I saw this, not knowing what am I looking at? And then suddenly, in almost a jump scare shot, we see this hand grab the rung of a ladder. And thus begins the chase. And the chase culminates in what people now refer to as the vertigo effect. It's achieved by zooming the camera lens in one direction, i.e., in, and dollying the camera backwards, in this case, in the opposite direction, out. I think they interchange some of those effects, zoom out and dolly in. But this was kind of influential. Here we see Jimmy Stewart so depressed that he can't speak. And Midge clearly is very concerned about him. I often like to call Jimmy Stewart good old Jimmy Stewart because he was every man for his generation. And here he is really gone for a fall. Midge has just left from a very unsatisfying interview with his shrink, and she is walking down a lonely hallway with not knowing what to do about her friend Scotty. And I want to call your attention to an establishing shot showing the road that they're driving on in a very wide angle. It is a single two-lane road, and he's driving on the wrong side of the road in this shot. There are many explanations for this that I've encountered. One person said, oh, it was really a divided highway. Well, you don't see that in the establishing shot. It's clearly a normal two-lane road. I think it's there to create tension in a very subtle way. He's trying to get Judy to confess to what the plot was.
It's funny because Hitchcock was known for not liking to film on location. He liked having the studio control. But he uses locations brilliantly whenever he uses them.
He loved the idea of locations, and he didn't mind doing it for the important shots. But as anyone who's made a movie outside knows, you cannot control the elements. And I really think that the core issue in Hitchcock's life, one of his greatest fears and what his films are about, is loss of control, and knowing that we feel the same thing. Sometimes when you watch the films, there's rear screen projection, and you know, a younger audience sometimes chuckles. But I'm just thinking, it shouldn't matter. I mean, it certainly works for me. And if you were working today, the technology is better, but I don't think the screenplays are. And I don't think we have Alfred Hitchcocks today. So I'll take the trade-off. Even when we can tell the, you know, occasionally imperfect matching of location and set, it doesn't bother me. And music, I think, goes a long way in helping that. That was something that Herman realized, was to take different elements of the separate pieces of film and, as he would say, make it feel like a seamless whole.
Some people have referred to this film as a love letter to San Francisco, and I think it clearly is. He very much enjoyed the town.
You know, that stunning sequence during that wordless montage when he's following Kim Novak around San Francisco, and she visits the grave of Carlotta Valdez. Those of us seeing that for the first time sometimes note that, oh, it's interesting that the filters that were used by Hitchcock to give that a very soft glow, there were no filters in front of the camera lens. Apparently the lighting was exactly the way it appeared in the finished film. And I didn't believe that until, once again, the Euler book reprinted one of Peggy Robertson's production report pages. Peggy Robertson was Hitchcock's secretary, in which she's listing the lenses and the time of day they were filming, and there's no mention of any filtration being put in front of the camera lens to give that dreamlike glow in that sequence.
I am one of the ultimate Vertigo devotees who, on just about each of my many business trips to San Francisco, I would try and hit at least one location. And I've been to the Mission Dolores there and been in that graveyard. And it's really evocative, you know? You go, oh, yeah, they did it here.
Stephen, you had mentioned something about the fact that there was some editing done to the film before it was released to the theaters, but they showed a different version to the critics. And there was, what happened? What was all that about?
Well, Herbert Coleman was Hitchcock's associate producer and really co-producer on these films. And he played an important role in getting the films executed properly and problem solving. And he gives perhaps the most vivid account of what I'm going to tell you briefly in his autobiography, The Man Who Knew Hitchcock. But basically, Hitchcock, as we know, liked to say that he didn't make mysteries. He made suspense films. And when the final writer on Vertigo, the one who really made it all come together, Samuel Taylor, said to Hitchcock, to make this a true Hitchcock film, don't you feel we need to let the audience know ahead of Scotty that Judy and Madeline are the same woman? And Hitchcock agreed, and they tried different ways of explaining that, and they settled on what Bernard Herrmann called in his music cue, the letter scene. It works for me just fine, but apparently neither man was satisfied completely with it, but they felt it worked. And then as reels of film were being shipped out, Herbert Coleman thought that Joan Harrison, who had been Hitchcock's assistant and then the producer of his TV series, felt that that scene revealing that Judy and Madeline were the same was a terrible mistake. And Hitchcock listened to someone who told him that and decided he wanted that scene cut out so that the audience, he felt, would realize that Judy and Madeline were the same only when Scotty finds it out, very close to the end of the film. So that scene was taken out, and there was a big music cut, there was an edit, but that was done. And then some more film reels were reel, whatever that was, 8 or 9 was redone. And then Hitchcock, who had a contract at Paramount that was, I will say, virtually unprecedented, because I think it was unprecedented in Hollywood. So, but just in case, I'll say virtually in having so much control over his films, he was overruled by Paramount because the film had been shown to critics with the scene revealing that Judy and Madeline were the same. So he was ordered by the heads of Paramount to put that scene back in. And Herbert Coleman, the producer, was begging him to put that scene back in. And Hitchcock agreed, and more money was spent, making new reels sent out. So there was a lot of confusion right before the film premiered. And fortunately, I think, that scene was put back in. It has wonderful music, but most critically, it makes us see that whole last 25 minutes of the movie totally differently. It allows us to change our allegiance, I think, even though she's a conspirator and a murderer. Our sympathies, I think, are with Judy as we watch Scotty become totally unhinged and become a character type that I've learned is all too familiar to a number of women, especially, who've had very controlling men doing things like that. And it's fascinating that Hitchcock encourages us to separate from James Stewart, from our leading man, and then we're as unmoored as he is by the end of the movie. I'm really amazed Paramount agreed to the film. and would it have been more successful with that scene cut? Probably not, because you'd still be left standing on that ledge hopelessly with Scotty Ferguson at the end.
This discussion was facilitated by film historian Max Alvarez, cinematography expert Dan Cahill, and resident film curator Gary Palmucci. Also, special thanks to Norma Levy, Marianne Tesler, Sean Moore, and Polly Rittenberg for making this podcast possible. This episode was produced, edited, and narrated by Hannah Kavanaugh. Yours truly. Thank you so much for listening, everyone, and be sure to RSVP for our next talkback on February 25th. Which will cover Francois Truffaut's 1960 gem, Shoot the Piano Player. You can find the link in the description.